Hello. So today we are working on solidarity or equity, and I'll start right away with that. The double word start. So the idea of what frequently is called equity today in discussions of ethics in computer science and information technology, that idea originated decades ago as the idea of solidarity. It's theoretically, it's the same or virtually the same idea. And it will trace, as we will see, it traces back to the philosophy of John Rawls. But for whatever reason, the title that we have attached to this idea has shifted in recent decades. And so what used to be called and originally was referred to in much of the literature as solidarity has now come to be named equity. I use both words, at least at the start, because you will find, depending upon what articles or things you're reading, you will find one or the other word featured. And finally, as I say, the common word today is equity. You do see that much more frequently than solidarity. But the main point is, theoretically, it's the same idea. They're just different moments culturally and historically. So today we are talking about either solidarity or equity. Choose whichever word you like. And we will start with this case from a few years ago now, one of the COVID disruptions in education. This is from England. And in England, like in the United States, and like many places, exams are taken for people in high school, or the more or less the equivalent of high school, and your scores on these exams determine your selection, either determine, in some cases, determine directly where you go to college, or in other cases, determine that the number of selections you have as to which colleges you can go to. The SAT is like the latter. The exams in England are somewhat more precise. It really is very much that the exam will channel you toward one or another school. And just like in most places, there is a high level of competition for certain schools. And there was a problem they had in the immediate post-COVID, or at the tail end of the COVID misadventure. And it's that, you remember, everything was canceled. All the exams were canceled and such. So when it came time to admit students to the next year's classes at some of these universities in England that were very highly sought after, they did not have, the students had not taken the entrance exams. They had all been canceled during COVID. So the universities had a problem. Who do we choose? How do we choose a class? How do we determine which pupils will be attending next year? And what they decided to do was to use a form of, loosely, a form of artificial intelligence, or I think more just information technology, to analyze students who had been admitted previously, and then so determine a sort of pattern of their educational background, where they went to school, what classes they had taken, and so on. So you have that pattern of students, and then you just take that pattern and apply it to this new class of students who had not been able to take the exam. And you say, well, look, if the students who gained admission to the university over the last 5 years tended to take this biology course and get this grade as a junior in high school and this grade as a sophomore and so on, then the students who had done that in the years before COVID, those students, we will predict, would have been the ones who would have passed this exam and would have come to been part of our class. Now, okay, that sounds good, right? I mean, no one is going to object in general to that idea. It sounds like, at least on the surface, a fair way of dealing with a very difficult situation. It makes good sense. But when they actually went through and did that process, there were some problems. Now, the most tangible problem was that historically, not surprisingly, the very best high schools had sent a far disproportionate number of their students to these leading colleges, and many high schools historically had not sent any students to these very highly sought after colleges. So, of course, the information technology, the AI, picked up on that. And once again, for the computer generated class of incoming students, no students were selected from many, many schools. Whereas by contrast, some few schools, a good chunk of the student body was selected and passed on to the leading university. No surprise, that's the machine doing what it was supposed to do. However, nestled in there, there is a kind of problem. There's a kind of fairness problem, which we can think about for just a moment. And there's also an equity problem, which I will explain in just a moment. Okay, so maybe you have considered that the fairness problem. The fairness problem is that the computer grading system gives the appearance of fairness, right? Because during the years when you had the exam, all the students took the same exam at the same time, right? So equals are treated equally, and some did well on the exam, others did extremely well, and others did not well. And those who did extremely well were passed on to these leading universities. So that's also fair. Unequals are treated unequally. Those who do score very well go to the leading universities. And those who do not, don't, right? It all works for fairness. But in this case, in the case of the computer generated scores, there is this small but nevertheless vital difference, is that even though it might be true that in years past, students from these leading schools disproportionately gained access to the certain universities, even though that might be true, it was also true that students from every high school across the country did get a chance on the exam. They may not have won entry to the leading school, but they had a chance. When the AI system was imposed, effectively what happened is those students never got a chance because their schools had never sent a student to the leading colleges and universities. Their applications or their profile was rejected right from the start without allowing them any input whatsoever into whether or not they should be selected. So there is this fairness problem, right? When you're actually doing the exams, even though the results end up balanced very heavily towards certain schools, at least it's true that everyone gets a chance. And for ethics and for fairness, that's important. Even if you don't win, you have a chance. In the computer-generated system, people just didn't have a chance. So there was a fairness objection to this creation of a new class by virtue of the test scores. That's one objection. It refers to the fairness we've discussed. There was also a second objection, the solution to unite society objection. And this falls more into the solidarity or equity area of consideration. The concern there was that, look, one thing that these standardized tests do is they tend to tear society apart. People who are privileged tend to get these advantages, and people who are not don't. So there's a kind of social tension inherent in these exams. Now, again, that social tension is alleviated to a certain extent because everyone does have a chance. But when certain people no longer have any chance at all, right, then that social tension also becomes aggravated. It becomes more notable. So there's the idea, it's not just that it's unfair that some people don't have a chance. There's also a broader social concern that a society is being split up into those who have the advantages and those that don't, right? When you eliminate any chance at all, right, then you have society clearly split into these two parts. So something like that is a solidarity or an equity objection. solidarity, as the name indicates, is this idea that the ethically right action is one that unifies a larger community or larger society, as opposed to tearing it apart. So, in the face of those two objections, the fairness idea and the solidarity idea, what was proposed was that instead of taking the students who would have been projected to be the best from in terms of the exam scores, they say, look, let's just instead go to each high school in the country and let's take the students who are the best performers in those high schools. And there we have years of data, right? Freshman, sophomore years, maybe junior years before COVID. Let's take from each school and in consultation, as you can see here with the with the teachers from those schools, let's go to each school and take the best students and have those best students then be gathered and be sent to the leading universities. This solves both the, perhaps solves both the fairness and the equity or solidarity problem. It solves the fairness problem because everyone now has a chance, right? The people who do best in every single school will be considered for admission to these universities. And some students from every single school will actually go to those universities. So everyone did have a chance. Secondly, with respect to the solidarity question, it seems as though this act does, to some extent at least, unify society. People from every part of society will together be gathered at these very desirable universities. So it seems like it brings people together instead of splitting them apart, splitting them in terms of those who go to the privileged high schools and those who do not. Right? That's the ripping apart part. That's the ripping apart option. And the unifying option is this idea that some students from every high school will be granted admission to these universities. So that's a case in solidarity or equity. And it's a case that I think shows something about how solidarity and equity works and also displays the way solidarity and equity is frequently defined. It's frequently defined in comparison with or sometimes in contrast with the idea of fairness. And then the final point I make here is that the protest, and I wanted to add at the end, that the protest, the person against the computer grades says that computer grades must go. Teachers really know, and the idea that the teachers at the school will decide which students or will significantly participate in the decision about which students progress to these universities. It seems to me that's not necessarily true. That is, the computer grades must go. It seems to me, in other words, that you can get the solidarity solution and you can get the response to the objection that it's not fair, the original computer grades system, by saying, look, we can still use the computer grades model to project which students would gain admission to these highly sought after universities. We can still use that model. It's just that instead of applying that model once across the entire population and selecting your group, you could apply that model within each high school. Because what the model does, in essence, is it just ranks the students, right? It says the one who is most likely to have passed the exam is John Smith, and the second most likely is Jane Jones, and on and on and on it goes. So you could apply that same AI or information technology model, you could apply it at each individual high school. And that would, it seems to me, that would alleviate both the fairness objection and the solidarity concern. Or it would at least alleviate the fairness objection that we talked about earlier. There might be other new fairness objections that arise because of this solution, but that's a little different discussion. What I want to do now is focus just on what solidarity is and how it worked in this case. So I think that the case is a good case because it displays what solidarity is. But the picture I used, and this is kind of the rallying cry, this is the reason it was reported in many of the newspapers and so on, is because there was this use of computer grading, of a computer grading system. And from what, from the way I am presenting the example here, again, it's just like, as I always want to say, there are more discussions that could be had. For example, we could, and I'm assuming that the initial use of the computer generated system was unfair, but we haven't proven that, and there are arguments on the other side, right? So there's always many, many counter arguments that I'm leaving out of our discussion, but that's necessary to make progress. But what I want to say here is that the idea that computer grades are unfair and not and do not participate in solidarity or social unification, that idea I think is wrong. It's true that computer grades grading brought up these objections, but I believe there are also solutions that use computer grading that answer those objections. And as I say, the easiest one is just to take the same AI model and apply it at each high school instead of applying it across the whole universe of high school graduates. Okay, so that's a long introduction to what solidarity and equity is and how it contrasts with fairness, or how it frequently arises sort of along, I'm not sure that it contrasts with fairness necessarily, but it tends to arise alongside discussions of fairness or discussions that occur against the background of how society works together generally. Okay, so that's the sense of what equity is. It is, as I say, the way we arrange these sessions is first, there's always try to pick up on the human sensation or feeling of the idea, whether it's autonomy or privacy or equity here. And then we try to put it in theoretical terms. And I think just to wrap this up, the how can equity be described or measured? I think that the human sensation of equity is the feeling of being left out or being left behind, right? It's the feeling you would have if you really wanted to go to University X and you're told you have to take an exam, and you took the exam and you did not do well on the exam, so you did not get to go to University X. That's one feeling. But the other feeling is you want to go to University X and someone told you, you know what, this year you don't have any chance at all. Right? We're not even going to have the exam. Just we've decided that because you're where you are, you don't even get to try. It seems like that's a different feeling, right? And that second feeling, that feeling about being left behind or left out or excluded, those kinds of human sensations, those are the kinds of human sensations that surround and intersect with this idea of the ethics of solidarity. So that's the human side. Let's think about the theoretical side, and we can do as we normally do. We can take a quick look at what ChatGPT tells us. We can take a quick look at what ChatGPT tells us, and let's see what we have here. And we will say define equity. Equity in ethics in 50 words or less. Okay, so let's see if we can define equity in ethics for us. Okay, so what ChatGPT does is it just says equity is the same thing as fairness. Understandable, it's very close. But what we are going to do in this session is show exactly how that's almost the entire session is set against ChatGPT. We are going to show how that is equity is not fairness. It's something slightly different. All right. So ChatGPT fails again. No surprise at this point. But it's still interesting to see how it fails. Right. And the way it failed here is it was too broad, because equity, in some sense, is part of fairness, but only in the very general sense. Any advance into understanding the idea of equity leads very quickly to the distinction between the theory and ethics of fairness and the theory and ethics of solidarity or equity. So let's look at the philosophical or the serious definition of solidarity or equity, depending upon how you want to call it. And to get to that definition, we need to go through two steps, and these steps are taken from a book called The Theory of Justice by an author called John Rawls from the early 1970s. In the United States, this book is one of the significant ethical philosophical productions in the history of American philosophy. And John Rawls was historically one of the leading American philosophers. What he proposes, again, is a two-step way of understanding or reaching the theory of what he called, and what people at that time called, solidarity, but which now would be called equity. And the first step starts with two ideas that are very famously linked to John Rawls. One is the original position, and the other is the veil of ignorance, including psychological blindness. What does that mean? Here's what Rawls does. Rawls says, look, the way we should figure out how, let's say, social goods should be distributed in society. So the way, for example, admissions to a very desirable colleges or universities, the way that social good, that desirable social thing, the way that should be distributed across society, that's the main subject that I want to study, Rawls says. And the way to begin thinking about that, or the way to begin imagining how those social goods should be distributed, is through a position of pure neutrality, one where I don't have any particular bias toward or reason to favor one or another set of people. Okay, makes sense so far. But the question is, how do we achieve that kind of neutrality or freedom from bias? And this is what he proposes as a thought experiment. He says, imagine yourself in an original position. Okay, so this is the original position part. Imagine yourself in an original position behind a veil of ignorance, which means you are blinded to or do not know anything about, usually you think of a veil of ignorance means you don't know about others. In this case, it means you do not know anything about yourself. This is the key. This is what you're blindfolded to. You're blindfolded to yourself. So you don't know your name. You don't know your age. You don't know your gender. You don't know your religion. You don't know whether you happen to be born with very great mathematical skills or not very good skills at all in terms of school, or maybe you're good at basketball, but not spelling. Who knows, right? All of us know in society, just looking around at the people that exist, we see this huge diversity of abilities and yes, inabilities, right? For instance, in my case, I'm very bad at dancing, for example. I just can't do it. I'm hopeless. And I have many other inabilities too, besides that. Everyone has their inabilities and their abilities. Now, what Rawls is onto here is he says, look, people have grown so accustomed to their abilities, and I will take myself as kind of an example of that. I mean, there are some things at which I am pretty good. I am pretty good at philosophy and the kind of thinking, the kind of organizing of ideas and presenting of an idea of ideas that relate to that specific field of information, which is a very different kind of expertise than someone might have in computer science. And maybe I have a strong expertise in the philosophical area of thinking, but I'm not good in the computer science way of thinking. And maybe I'm also not a good literary writer, right? That's a little bit different skill, someone who writes a novel or something. And then that's just the academic level. Then, as I say, there's all kinds of other stuff. Like am I good at tennis? I've already told you I'm really bad at dancing. So, I mean, it wouldn't be surprising. We'll just take a quick example. And since I'm not good at dancing and I'm good at philosophy, if you just put me in charge of selecting what students, in this case in England, would go on to this very desired college, and I just sort of had to look at them and choose, I mean, it wouldn't be surprising that I sort of started to think, you know, the students who do well in the philosophy class, you know, they would be good ones to send over there. And it probably would not occur to me to ask, which one of you are good at dancing, right? Because it's just natural that since I'm bad at it, I think most people think that they do not do well. They don't get very strongly involved with. So they tend to begin to think they're unimportant, right? And that's just natural. That's not a problem with the way someone acts in the world. We have limited time. So we tend to spend our time and our effort focused on things that we're at least decently good at. Things that we're bad at, we just give up on. So that's going to really affect the way, even if I'm trying to be perfectly fair, if I'm selecting the class, the students for next year's classes at these universities, even if I'm trying to be perfectly fair, there's no way I can compensate for the fact that I've spent my entire life thinking that dancing is unimportant. Whereas by contrast, someone who's a very good dancer might think, well, this is actually a very important part of adult life, and it should be considered when we think about who should go to what colleges and so on. And so just your personal experience, there's just no way to avoid that. The things that you are good at and not good at and your personal way of having lived in the world is going to affect the way you make decisions about things. And what Rawls is trying to do is he's trying to the degree possible, eliminate that that kind of bias. I don't think anyone thinks it's possible to do in some pure sense, but you can take a step in that direction. And that's what the veil of ignorance is. It's the idea that when we are distributing benefits, like who gets into this college, we don't know anything about ourselves. And then another way in which that works, which it seems to me it does actually have a positive function, it's not just eliminating things that we tend to discriminate against, like people who are good dancers or what have you. Another way that has a positive function is something like the following. In society, many decisions are made in terms of, let's just say, income taxes. How much, a common debate every 4 years in the United States and probably everywhere in the Western world where there's a democratically elected leaders, part of what they debate whenever they do an election is how taxes should be imposed. That is, should people who earn more money pay more as a percentage than people who earn less? Should they pay a lot more? Should everyone pay the same? So these kinds of questions are just standard political questions in democratic republics. Now, what Rawls says is, look, remember, if you're behind the veil of ignorance and you're deciding something like what the tax structure will be, you don't know whether you yourself are very wealthy or very poor or somewhere in the middle. Similarly, with respect to any other kind of social good, where highways will be built, you don't know where you live. Things like rules that protect or do not protect certain genders or races from discrimination. Right? It might be one thing, I might have one position, let's say, about protections against racial discrimination against racial minorities. I might have one position myself right now, but then if you said to me, wait a minute, Brousseau, what is your position if you don't know, right? If I'm behind the veil of ignorance, if I don't know whether I am black or white or Asian or add more things to it, male or female, etc. Maybe if I did not know my race or my gender, then I might say, you know what? I'm a little bit worried that it might turn out when they take off my blindfold, that on the one hand, I would say, well, we should have no protections for anyone. Everything should just be wide open and people do what they want. But then I'm a little worried that what if it turns out when I take off my blindfold that, let's say, I'm a black woman and it turns out that in the society that actually exists, I'm receiving adverse discrimination for one or another reason. Now, in that case, I might say, you know what, since I don't know, but this is the key point, since I don't know my gender or my race, I might set up certain rules to protect groups that have been historically disadvantaged, or I might not. And we don't know which way you will go, but the point is, this idea is that you don't know beforehand what you are going to be. You can see here, they're kind of trying this in this design in the image. You can see they're trying to put all kinds of different people. One obvious case would be age. This is a question that is going to become increasingly important as our ability to keep people alive with advanced medical technology increases. We are going to be spending increasing amounts of money in keeping very old people alive in ways which are, let's say from my perspective, appear to be not very active. Right? People who spend most of their time in bed or in a chair, but they can continue biologically living for quite some time. Now, maybe if you say to someone like me, someone who's still, or even maybe if I'm 22, maybe I would say something like, look, I'm all in favor of the elderly, but we cannot continue to let the elderly consume 50% of our public budget for their healthcare. We need to spend more of that money on things like education and so on that benefit younger people because they have more time to live. They're more active in the world. It makes a lot of sense. A 22-year-old might well think that. Whereas by contrast, the 92-year-old might think, you know, we need to really spend more money on these old people like me to keep us healthy and going and active because we've already contributed quite a bit to society and so on. So when you're thinking about how government money should be spent, a 22-year-old and a 92-year-old might have very different perspectives on that. And again, here, the veil of ignorance says, look, it's not, is one or the other right? It's instead, how would you choose if you don't know whether you are 22 or 92? Right? That's the key. It's, for Rawls, it's not the idea that there is a right or wrong answer, at least at this first stage. Instead, it's the idea that whatever conclusion you come to is right as long as it is generated legitimately from behind this veil of ignorance. That is, if you really don't know whether you're 22 or 92, then the decision you make about how money should be allocated in society, more toward healthcare for the elderly or education for the youngins, right? Whichever decision you make will be, in some sense, a good one or justified, right? Because you don't know whether or not it will benefit you personally. So that's the first step of Rawls's idea of solidarity. It's the idea that we can make, or we attempt to make decisions about the distribution of social benefits. We attempt to make those decisions from a position of neutrality. And the way we do that, or the way we achieve that neutrality, is through this thought experiment of the veil of ignorance, which occurs, what he calls, from the original position, because it's the original position because this is the way in which you set things up in a society. So at the very start, you don't know if you're going to be rich or poor. You don't know if you're going to be young or old. So you set things up in society so that a certain amount of money goes to the 92-year-olds, a certain amount 22, certain taxes here, rates here, certain taxes there. You do those things just in a way you would do if you didn't know where you were going to land in the society. Right? So that's the veil of ignorance, which occurs from the original position and which presumably guarantees a kind of objective view about how social goods and advantages should be distributed. So that's step one. Step two, here's where things get a little bit blurry. Rawls says, look, if you start out doing step one, and most people agree that the idea of the veil of ignorance and the original position is a fairly ingenious way of starting out. I mean, if you could make it work, maybe there's a practical objection that you cannot actually do that. But leaving that aside, we're philosophers. If you could make it work, many people believe, yeah, this is a pretty good way to distribute society's goods. Makes sense. Where Rawls goes next is he says, okay, I think it's a good way too, but I think more than that. I think that rational people will tend to come to a set of conclusions which overlap, which are more or less, everyone will more or less come to some general conclusions about the way these social goods should be distributed. And here I will read a famous line from him. He says, social and economic inequalities, for example, inequalities of wealth and authority, authority would be something like prestige, he means, are just only if they result in compensating benefits for everyone, and in particular for the least advantaged members of society. So it's that last part. So if we have inequalities of wealth and authority, I guess authority is not exactly, it's prestige, but also direct power, right? There's some mix of those things going on. So for example, a judge would have a certain amount of power, which is greater actually than their wealth. So judges or politicians or police officers, those are people who have real authority in different ways in society that is greater than their wealth. Whereas by contrast, someone like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, those are people who would have wealth in society, which is imbalanced and much greater than their formal authority or prestige, right? Rawls is talking about both those things. He's talking about those who are privileged in some sense, in terms of just flat money, but also in terms of their social position and what people think of where they are and how they are and so on. So all that stuff, all that kind of good stuff, you most people kind of want, right? Most people want money and want authority and want prestige. It makes sense. All those good things, Rawls says, may exist in society in unequal amounts, just as they do now, of course, for us, but only if those inequalities result in compensating benefits for everyone, and in particular for the least advantaged members of society. Now, there are two ideas here, and we need to get into both of them. If they result in compensating benefits for everyone. So in other words, the first part is we will allow inequalities if everyone benefits from them. And this is there are lots of many, many arguments surrounding this idea, but we will just look at one. That there is a standard economic argument that most people subscribe to some extent, and that is that some form of economic inequality does in fact benefit everyone, because competition creates, on the one side, it creates inequalities. Those who do better succeed more, gain more wealth, and so on. But the way that you typically, at least in the way our societies are organized, hopefully, let's say not typically, at least hopefully, right? The way you gain economic wealth and an advantage in a competitive world is by doing a better job than other people. So let's just say that I want to start a pizza restaurant. It's a competitive world. The way I will gain wealth, the way my restaurant will succeed, is by producing better pizza than my competitors at a lower price. So I end up, let's say that I do that, and I end up getting wealthy because everyone wants to come to my restaurant. Okay, that's great. What Rawls says is, look, what's going on there is that it's true that we have an inequality. Now I'm wealthier than, let's say it's really successful and I get pretty wealthy. So now I'm wealthier than most people. That's true. We have that inequality. But it's also true that, at least to some extent, everyone else benefits as well, because everyone else gets better pizza for lower prices. So something like that argument is the one about how inequalities benefit everyone. This is not an economics class, so we're not going to debate about the extent to which that's true, or whether or not the inequalities can become so great that they stop benefiting everyone, and where those thresholds are. All those are very interesting and important debates. But for our purposes, there's first this idea that Rawls is not just saying that everyone has to get exactly the same. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, look, we can have inequalities in society, but, and now here we come to the second part, and we can have inequalities in society because they benefit, at least in many cases, they benefit everyone. It's good to have inequality in society, according to Rawls and this position. Then we come to the second part, which is that for Rawls, he says, look, I agree that these inequalities benefit everyone, but they must most benefit, right? This is really key. They must most give the most benefit to the least advantaged members of society. So it's not enough, going back to my pizza restaurant example, it's not enough for me to simply say, look, because I made this better pizza at a lower price, which benefited everyone, now I can get super wealthy. I must also say, for Rawls, I must also say, look, this particular benefit tends to help most, even more than it helps me, it helps most, at least if you add up all the benefit across all the people, it helps most the least advantaged members of society. That is, people who would be among me. It doesn't have to be, but there's always some flexibility here. It doesn't have to be exactly the very poorest person in society, but amongst that group of the relatively less wealthy members of society, the benefit must be concentrated there. And maybe in the pizza restaurant, if I'm selling slices in the street, I could maybe make that argument. I could say, look, it's true that I'm getting wealthy here, but the greatest benefit really, and that arises from my company, is not to me. It's from the working class guys and girls who are out there. You know, all they can afford for lunch is a pizza. They can't go to these fancy schmancy restaurants, right? All they can get is their pizzas. And so I'm giving them better pizza at a lower price. So this inequality actually does fulfill Rawls's criteria. That is, that it gives the greatest advantage to the least advantaged. Now, just like I say so often in this class, we could stop here and we could talk about this for the whole semester. Easily. We could bring in guest lecturers from economics and sociology and history and so on. And there would be no end to it. So I realize that there are many possible objections to what I've said so far, of course. But we are kind of stepping past them because we do need to move on. And I think that what I've said so far indicates, right, this idea of the pizza restaurant, it indicates in general terms what Rawls's thought is and how solidarity is supposed to work and what it actually means to say that we can have inequalities as long as they benefit the least advantaged members of society. Now, if that's right, then we can convert that into what is frequently called the max-min principle for Rawls, and that is in general, what equity or solidarity demands in general, as sort of a broad rule, now that we've gone through the first step of the original position and veil of ignorance, and then we've taken the second step and we've said anyone in that position would arrive at this conclusion about how things should be distributed, now we can arrive at our definition of solidarity and equity and say that in general, equity means that the maximum advantage should be distributed to the least advantaged. And that sometimes is also called the difference principle. So inequality only if it most benefits the least advantaged. So that's one way of saying what defining what solidarity or equity is. It's the maximum advantage to the least advantaged. There's also sort of a second articulation of that idea, which is the idea of inclusiveness in the sense that no one is left behind. I mean, if it's true that you're always trying to arrange things like artificial intelligence and pizza restaurants and everything else so that it gives the greatest advantage to the least advantaged, then definitionally people are not being left behind, right? The people who have the least money or the people who benefit least from artificial intelligence technology, if from now on, whenever we make AI or develop a new AI tool, we say, let's make sure that this tool is optimized to help those who, and to aid those who have received the least benefit so far from artificial intelligence. If we have that in mind, then just definitionally, that is inclusiveness in the sense that no one is left behind because we are literally making the machine, the tool, for those people who are least advantaged. So you can talk about the idea of solidarity or equity in either of those two ways, right? Or those are two different sides of the same coin, let's say. You can say, look, it's the maximum advantage to the least advantage, or it's inclusiveness, meaning no one is left behind. So those are the two aspects of the philosophical and ethical definition of what equity or solidarity is. Okay, so I can give you just some quick real-world examples of what this looks like. We'll start with a real-world example in information technology. This is something I just happened to see recently. It is a new app, Be My AI, with the AI, with the I as in intelligence, also meaning I as in what you see with visibility. And this is a tool for the blind or for the those who are nearly blind. What it is artificial intelligence. When you take your camera phone and aim it at some object, what the artificial intelligence does is it recognizes that object and then gives a spoken description of what exists. And here's so it's on your phone. So you see one on the side there, there's the phone, and you see how you aim the picture, the camera, phone camera at something, and the image goes into the phone, and then that connects to the Beam My AI app, and it produces a description of that image for the blind, because of course they can't see what is there. And here's a real example. So someone is holding this box of chocolates, and they bring up the phone to focus on it. And what the phone says, using artificial intelligence recognition and then voice technology to produce the words and so on, the phone says, the picture shows a box of assorted pastries and sweets. The box is being held by someone. There are some white. There are some with a swirl of chocolate or pink frosting, some with nuts on top, and da-da-da-da. So you can see, at least in this case, which I took from the company itself, so I'm not sure how well, this is not an ad for this app, I'm not sure how well it functions, but at least in this case, which the company chose to exhibit, yeah, it works pretty well. You can see how artificial intelligence, in this case, the kind of technology that we see and are using all the time now in ChatGPT, and in deepfake technology, and in generative image production, and text recognition, and object recognition for driverless cars, all that kind of stuff, all that kind of technology, which could and frequently is aimed at helping the most advantaged, the wealthiest. Just think, for example, this technology has quite a bit of overlap. It's not the same, but has quite a bit of overlap with the technology that is developed for driverless cars. And of course, driverless cars are, like the Tesla is quite expensive. And so these are cars which are aimed in general toward the wealthier edges of society, at least at the moment. And that might change. But right now, a lot of this image recognition technology, the way it exists in the real world for consumers, it exists for those who can pay more money for things. It's a luxury item, right? What Solidarity does is it takes that same technology and it says, okay, how can we use this technology in a way that it benefits not those who can pay most, but those who can pay only very little or perhaps not at all. And then that leads to say, well, here's some people we can really help with this technology. And if we use it to aid the way they live their lives, which I think it's obvious that there are many situations in which for someone who's blind, this could be extraordinarily helpful. Even though there might not be the same degree of profit in that use of technology, there is the fulfillment of the ethical ideal of solidarity in that the technology is being used inclusively. No one is being left behind. The blind are not being left behind in this case. And the maximum advantage is being distributed to those who are, at least some of those who are in some ways the least advantaged. Again, I don't want to be too, for the sake of efficiency, we're just saying things like the greatest advantage and least advantage. But of course, it's never that simple in any particular case. Some people who are disadvantaged in one way are advantaged in others. You know, of course, all that is true. But again, we would be here for hours and hours if we got all the details perfectly correct. I think this is a pretty good example in general of what equity or solidarity looks like in the world of AI technology. We're just taking that image recognition and other language model powers and reorienting it away from those who can pay for the Tesla motor cars or pay the OpenAI subscription, and orienting those powers toward people who are blind or severely limited in terms of what they can see. Solidarity. Another example of solidarity, I will just do this quickly. This very much emphasizes the idea of inclusiveness, is from a novel from the 1960s. That solidarity is an idea that, of course, is, we've had solidarity as long as there have been human beings and communities. what Rawls adds is kind of a formal definition of it, but there's all kinds of literary discussions of solidarity in one form or another. And this is from Simone de Beauvoir, depending on how you want to pronounce it, a French author, of course. And she wrote this short story called Who Shall Die, which is a study, among other things, in the idea of solidarity and inclusiveness. I will quickly recount the story that a town this is in a medieval time, so think of like knights and kings and stuff in their castles, and a town is under siege, and everyone in the town has retreated to the castle, so they're inside the castle and surrounded by the enemy, who are shooting arrows at them and that kind of unhappy stuff. And the people in the castle are running out of food, so they have to decide how the food should be distributed. The French title is actually The Useless Mouse. The English title is Who Shall Die? And they decide that initially decide that the food should be given to the warriors, the fighters, because they're the ones who are most able to resist the attacks, or they are the ones who resist the attacks of the marauding invaders. But then after some time, people make the decision that in essence, what's happening is we're leaving part of our society behind. Some people are going to die of starvation while we are feeding the soldiers in this bid to fight off the enemy. Now, of course, that makes perfect sense. There's no one who thinks that that's a bad solution. It makes perfect sense. The other choice, as you find out at the end of the book, the other choice is just for everyone to die because the marauders come in and kill everyone. So it makes perfect sense rationally. It's entirely justifiable to say, look, we have to distribute the food to those people who are willing and able to defend us from these attacking marauders. Makes sense. However, in later discussions, the citizenry opted for a solidarity or inclusiveness approach. And they said, what we're going to do is we're going to value most highly the society as one unit. And so we will share the food equally. And then we will rush out of the castle and attack the marauders, and everyone, not just the soldiers, but everyone in the society will together be an attacker, and we will try to fight them off. Now that's vain, they're going to lose, but the idea is that they would prefer to be, in the end, they would prefer to be inclusive or together as a group, instead of split up between those who are advantaged or useful and those who are not useful. Maybe either way, things were going to end poorly, but it's a good, it's a classic literary example of what equity or solidarity looks like in a literary context. And then the final example I have, I asked ChatGPT to put in Rawls's Max Min principle, and you can see that ChatGPT described it more or less correctly. The concept is symbolically depicted through the representation of a progressively rising platform with figures of varying sizes, highlighting the focus on maximizing the welfare of the least advantaged in society. So the description of the Max Min that ChatGPT produced is right, is good in this case. However, the image, it looks like it's completely the opposite of what it's supposed to be, at least to me. Everyone, I mean, it's arts and making your own decisions, but it looks to me like the image is one where the entire society is worshiping this one guy up on top there. So it looks like the opposite. And it looks like the way that ChatGPT is depicting solidarity is completely inverse solidarity. It's the idea that there's this one exceptional person and everyone else is arrayed beneath that person. And apparently it almost looks like they are there to serve that one high and mighty being. It seems like that's the opposite of what solidarity and equity is. Though again, that doesn't mean this is, there are other theories you could use to justify this as the right way to organize society. It's an endless debate in political science and so on. But this does not, at least to me, does not look like a representation of what equity or solidarity is. Again, you have to decide for yourself. Okay, so we have seen a physical sense of what solidarity feels like, right? The sense that you're left behind, you don't even get a chance to apply to these universities. And then we've looked at the Rawls definition of what solidarity is, the maximum advantage to the least advantaged, coupled with the idea of inclusiveness or no one left behind. So I would just take a minute to define, you can define your own example of solidarity in information technology or elsewhere. Okay, so what we will look at now is fairness and equity, or fairness and solidarity slash equity, in comparison. I've been saying that, and we saw also with the ChatGPT at the very start, that the way most people start thinking about equity or solidarity is in tandem with the idea of fairness. The two are crisscrossed through each other and are very similar. Of course, both of them are also ways in which we think about how social advantages should be distributed in a society. Right? They're both part of the, just going all the way back to the start, we said that there's this sense in which the principles of privacy and dignity and autonomy, these principles are about the ethics of me and my existence in the world. And now we're doing fairness, solidarity, equity, and we will do social well-being. These are principles about us, about how we exist together in the world. So, of course, there's going to be quite a bit, since they have that same approach to what ethics concerns individuals with others in the world. Of course, there's going to be quite a bit of overlap, and we will look at some of those overlaps now. This is just a list I have drawn of very briefly, some of the ways of highlighting the differences between Aristotle and Rawls, which is to say between fairness and equity and social well-being, equity and solidarity. So we saw that for Rawls, fairness means equals treated equally and unequals proportionally unequally within the decision domain. For Rawls, equity means the greatest advantage to the least advantaged. So that's the clear difference. I think it's also true that for fairness, there's an ideal process that everyone is treated equally, dictating an outcome. Whereas for Rawls, there's an ideal outcome dictating a process. For Aristotle, the process is that everyone is treated equally. For Rawls, the outcome is inclusiveness, that the society is held together. And that's what dictates the process. So the process would be something like, going back to the start, how do you determine which students go to which college? That's the process. And the outcome, of course, is which students end up there. So what Aristotle does is he says, let's get a good process, and that will determine the outcome. It will determine which students end up at these colleges. Rawls says, no, we have to have an ideal outcome, which is that the students who are at these colleges come from the represent all the segments of society, not just the leading high schools, but all of society. That's the outcome. So we should make a process that assures that. For fairness, equality applies to opportunities, that they want to have everyone have a chance. For Rawls, equality applies to outcomes. They want to make sure that at the end of the day, everyone is represented, let's say. For Aristotle, society is a collection of individuals. For Rawls, individuals are aspects of a larger society. So I think that's a good distinction, right? This idea of, it's the idea of, like, where does thinking start? And for those who want to do fairness, what's primary, what's most important is how individuals are treated in the world, whereas for those who want to start with equity and solidarity, where they start and what they want to privilege is how society should be. So if you start from individuals, you think, well, I've got an idea of what individuals should be, and society is just a bunch of those people. Whereas for Rawls and equity, we start with the idea of, well, there's this idea of what society is or should be, and then individuals are participants in that ideal. And I kind of say the same thing again here. For fairness, treating individuals justly defines what it means to have a good society. So if you treat individuals well, you get a good society. For Rawls, a good society defines what it means to treat individuals justly. So there you start with the society you want, right? The great society that you believe in, and then that will tell you how individuals should be treated. And I think fairness is fundamentally about individuality, whereas at least in comparison to equity, and equity is about inclusiveness. For those who advance the idea of fairness, they say what's most important is that everyone can advance. For those who go for equity and solidarity, what's important is that no one is left behind. So I think this captures sort of theoretically the differences between fairness and solidarity. And so this is a very theoretical slide. Here's a very practical slide that kind of says the same thing. This is a famous thought experiment proposed by someone named Robert Nozick, and it is proposed against. Robert Nozick did not like John Rawls. I don't mean as a person, but I mean, though maybe, who knows? But did not like the theory that John Rawls was promulgating, and so Nozick proposes this idea of an experiment. It's not exactly a thought experiment, it's more of a hypothetical experiment. Nozick says, okay, let's imagine a society where wealth is distributed evenly. That is, we're just talking about money now, and everyone has the same amount. So in that case, if we start there, then everyone is happy, right? I mean, no one can say anything is unfair or anything is wrong. Everyone has the same amount. Let's just start there. Everyone is happy. No complaints, no objections, all good. Let's just start there. Then he says, okay, let's imagine there's a basketball star. And back then, the big star was Wilt Chamberlain. Today, the big star might be someone else, but it doesn't matter who. There's a big star, and this star negotiates a contract where spectators place an extra 25 cents in a separate box to see him play. So it's kind of a fun experiment. What Nozick imagines is, every time you go to the stadium to watch a basketball game, you pay for your normal ticket. But if Wilt Chamberlain is playing, you have to pay an extra 25 cents. Now, no one is forcing you to go to the game, but what Nozick is pointing out is that people really liked to go see Wilt Chamberlain. Those were the big games. Those were the ones that people wanted to see. And so it makes sense to say, look, we will just charge an extra 25 cents to spectators for those games. And if they don't want to pay that, they don't have to go to the game. Fine. But if they want to see Wilt Chamberlain, and a lot of them do, they will be happy to pay the extra 25 cents because it's a really good game. You get to see this really good player. So the deal is transparent. The team agrees and spectators voluntarily pay. That's important, right? All this is transparent. Everyone agrees to it. No one is being forced to do anything. And at year's end, that's a lot of quarters. How many more quarters? That's millions, that's a lot of spectators. At the year's end, Chamberlain has $250,000 more than other players and members of society. Okay, so now we're at the end of the year, and remember, we started, everyone in society had the same amount of money. Now everyone in society has the same amount of money, except Wilt Chamberlain has this extra, I'm not sure how 25 cents got to be $250,000, but it did somehow, has this extra amount, and we have wealth inequality. We no longer have this and pleasant inclusiveness. So the question is, now what? What Nozick says is that nothing is wrong with the wealth distribution at the start. Everyone agreed, just flat. Everyone has the same. Chamberlain, extra wealth acquired by free and fair individual choices. So there's nothing wrong with the way wealth acquired. So there's nothing wrong with keeping it. What Nozick is saying here is, look, this experiment shows that we can have societies which are not inclusive, in which people are left behind. In this case, one guy is leaving everyone else behind, but we can imagine it the other way, right? And we could imagine that almost everyone earned the extra money and only a few people didn't. What Nozick is saying is, look, if we start out in a situation in which it's everything seems perfectly fair, and then we have some changes in the situation, which everyone agrees are fair changes. No one is forced to do anything. Everyone just acts voluntarily. No one got any kind of unfair advantage. Though maybe you could say, look, Will Chamberlain got an unfair advantage because of how he was born, like really tall and really powerful. But just go with it. Go with the example. what Nozick says is, look, in that case, it's really unfair to do something like penalize Will Chamberlain with higher taxes to try to bring him back to the group. It's really unfair to insist upon solidarity, meaning everyone has about the same amount of money after taxes because we tax the high-end earners at a much higher rate. Nozick says, no, we should not do that because it's just blatantly and directly unfair. What is required for inclusiveness and solidarity in this case, assuming solidarity means that we're going to tax those who have the most to give more to those who have the least, assuming solidarity means we're going to have the max min, right, the maximum advantage, the least advantage, then we're going to have to tax Will Chamberlain to give the money to the poorest school districts, let's just say. assuming that's what solidarity and equity is, Nozick says, then it is unfair. And you can see it with this example. There's a direct conflict between the two ways of thinking about the world. And therefore, Nozick says, we should not, because it's unfair, we should not have societies which are based upon solidarity and equity. In fact, Nozick goes all the way and sort of plays with the idea that we should not even have taxation. That he says, look, taxation and redistribution are, in some ways, redistribution of wealth, are some ways inherently unfair and unjust. Now you can draw your own conclusions about that, but the experiment itself is quite compelling, again, which doesn't mean that it's necessarily convincing, but it does do a good job of making a fairness argument against solidarity, right? If you start out with a situation in which everything is fair, we all have the same amount of money, and then you make some changes in which everything still is fair because people do what they want with transparency, no one has any objection along the way. And then you end up in a situation of radical social inequality, then there's no reason to try to correct that. Stronger, the attempt to correct it, that itself is unfair. So for Nozick, the kinds of taxation that occurs upon the wealthy in order to redistribute to the less advantaged, that is fundamentally unfair and we should not have it. And maybe we should not have taxes at all, and that kind of thing. Again, there's a lot more to be said there, but you can see in this example how it's possible to clearly pull apart fairness from solidarity or equity. Right? And then that goes back to the beginning when we talked about ChatGPT saying that solidarity or equity is a form of fairness. No, it's not. Right? This clearly shows how you can see, if you look carefully, you can see how the two split severely upon the way this single person should be treated, Will Chamberlain. Okay, so that's a famous experiment, thought experiment, or hypothetical experiment. And again, what's important about that is it shows how equity and fairness are at loggerheads, at least sometimes. They're mutually exclusive. On the other hand, it's also true, come to this case, where we would say that fairness and equity are sometimes overlapping. So here we have three cases. In the case on the left, we have fairness, but not equity. This is fair because these are three people, and everyone is getting, they're equals in that way. They're three people, and they're treated equally. Each one gets a little boost. That's definitely not equity, though. Where everyone just gets one box is definitely not equity, because equity insists that we give the greatest advantage to the least advantaged. So where equity is would be at the other extreme, where the shortest person gets two boxes, the medium person gets one box, and then the tall person gets no boxes, But you can see here the tall person now can't see or can't see very well. This is equity, right? The least, at an extreme case, the least advantage gets the greatest advantage, to the point where the least advantage is actually the best off right at the end. I mean, that's what the theory does. It forces you to do that. If you're giving the greatest advantage to the least advantaged, then the theory does force you, if you're distributing just these boxes, so your choices are only the options you see here, it forces you to create a situation in which the least advantaged actually are the best off. Equity forces that in that case. So you can see how fairness on one extreme leaves the tall guy in really good shape, and the little baby, or little toddler, I'm not sure if it's a toddler or little guy, and a toddler in bad shape. And then the equity extreme leaves the toddler, the little guy, in really good shape, and the dad in not such a good in a position where he can barely see. And then there's the middle case, where it turns out the dad is a little bit taller, right, and everyone can see. In this case, this would be both equity and fairness. Right? It is equity because the greatest advantage is being given to the least advantage, with the two boxes given to the shortest person. But it's also fairness because unequals are being treated unequally. That is, people of different height are being given different amount of boosting. And that unequal treatment is proportional to their difference in height. So the shortest person gets the greatest boost, the middle person gets a little boost, and the tallest person gets no boost. Right? So that's fair. And it's also equity, right? Because the greatest advantage is going to the least advantaged. So you can say in that middle picture, you have both fairness and equity. But fairness seen differently, and it depends upon how, fairness depends, everything always depends, on how you see the situation. If you see these as just three people, then they're equals, and they should be treated equally, and therefore they should each get one box. If you see them as three people of different heights, then they're unequals, and they should be treated unequally, and they should get that sort of middle case fits them. Whereas by contrast, as I say, since equity always says no matter what, we should always give the greatest advantage to the least advantaged. Right? Equity says there's no way we can do that first or justify that first situation with three boxes, one for each. No way. It has to be one of the two where we have two boxes for the toddler and one box for the kid and no boxes for dad. And what equity says, look, says even in the case where what makes equity interesting in this example is that even in the case where the tallest person, the person who normally should get the best view, even in the case where that person ends up having the worst view, yes, that's the way it works if you're going to give the greatest advantage to the least advantage. For the person who promotes equity, that first case will seem very unjust where everyone gets one box. For the person who promotes fairness, that last case where the tallest person ends up being the one who can't see, that will appear to be very unjust. For those who promote equity and fairness, both will be able to agree that the middle case is just. So you can see, it's a confusing relationship. Equity and fairness, they cross through each other. Sometimes they overlap. Sometimes their principles, equals treated equally and unequal treated unequally versus greatest advantage to the least advantage. Sometimes those two principles, they correspond. They end up with the same output as you get here in the middle image. But sometimes they diverge and end up with different outputs. And so you see that in the Will Chamberlain experiment or in this case. And then I think one way, if you really want to study this philosophically, we will just do this quickly. But if we really wanted to take some time to go through this, and then what we would say is, Aristotle's equals equally and unequals unequally is fairness. What solidarity does is it just concentrates on that second part. It says, look, in the real world, what we have pretty much everywhere is unequals. Some people are privileged, some aren't. Some people are advantaged, some aren't. That's what really happens. And what we should do in the real world is we should always concentrate on that side, always the unequals, find the unequals, and always treat them unequally, but treat them unequally in a specific way by giving the greatest advantage to the least advantaged. So in this case, you could say that maybe solidarity and equity are a kind of a subset of fairness. And it takes the broad idea of fairness and works within a certain part of how that way of thinking operates. That might be a way you could bring the two together. Again, as I say, if this were a philosophy class, we would talk a long time about this, but this is not a philosophy class, so we will instead concentrate just upon this idea that they're fundamentally independent ideas. Aristotle says treat equals equally and unequals proportionally unequally within the decision domain, and Rawls is the greatest advantage to the least advantaged. And fairness is everyone can advance, and solidarity is no one left behind. Okay, so that's the fairness and solidarity distinction and overlapping. So why don't you take 5 minutes to sketch your own example of the fairness and equity distinction and overlap. Okay. Now, this is very quick. We're going to do the thought experiment very quickly, and then we will do some topics in equity. And there's actually just one thought experiment, so I will pose this to you. Two people, one cookie. How should the cookie be distributed? Now, we could think of the cookie, that could be in the world of information technology or artificial intelligence. That could be training data. It could be compute power. It could be the way we distribute any of the goods associated with the information technology economy. It could be, for example, we've talked earlier about vision object. Now I'm forgetting what the jargon term is, but object recognition software that recognizes, oh, that's a person, that's a car, that's a chocolate, that's an arm, right? That kind of recognition software. Where should that software be used? Should it be used and optimized first for cars for wealthy people, or should it be instead used first and optimized for helping the blind to see things that are going on around them, right? So something like that would be the cookie. What I mean by the cookie, it's some kind of socially good thing, data, applications, so on. So you have two people and one cookie, and the question is, well, how can you distribute this in ways that are both fairness and equity, that are not fair and equity, that are fair and not equity, and not fair and not equity, right? So this is just a rudimentary, basic thought experiment. I think that maybe the easiest one is, it's pretty easy to imagine something that's not fair and not equity. That would be that one person distracts the other person by saying, look over there, there's a car crash, and then that person eats the cookie while the other person doesn't see. That doesn't seem fair, it doesn't seem like equity, something like that. I think that the fair and equitable, I'll just let you think about it for a bit, for 20 seconds, and then, okay, or you can pause the video, think about it, that would be better, actually. Here's the solution I have. So I think it would be, it seems to me it would be fairness and equity if both get half a cookie. That's certainly fair because equals are treated equally. And if the two people are the same, there is no least advantage or most advantage. So you just give them each half a cookie. That seems equitable when assuming that people are kind of the same. It's two friends who are about the same, equally hungry and so on. The example I like of fairness, which is not equity, would be a lottery or a coin flip. I mean, you could easily imagine two friends making that decision, right? There's two friends together. They have one cookie. It's one of those very small cookies, so it's not worth splitting. So how do they decide who eats it? Well, they flip a coin. That's fair. Everyone agrees that's fair, right? You both have a 50-50 chance of getting it. Your equals are being treated equally. You flip the coin. You win. You lose. You get the cookie. You don't get the cookie. But that's not equity, because what equity would try to do, unless you get pushed back into the top category, what equity would try to do is find some way of saying, well, who is the least advantaged between us? Who is it that has had less cookies to eat recently? Or who, as I say in the other example, who is it that missed breakfast, right? You might say, look, if someone missed breakfast, then that person should get the cookie because they're hungrier, they missed breakfast, maximum advantage to the least advantaged. That doesn't seem really fair, though, because just because you missed breakfast, now I don't get a chance to get the cookie. That doesn't seem right. You should have had your breakfast. It's not my fault you didn't have breakfast, right? So it seems like it could be unfair to say that just because you lost skipped breakfast, that I should not get a chance at the cookie. But that's equity, right? So I think you can say, in the case of just a simple cookie, that there's a response which is fair and equitable. Give each person half. There's a response which is fair but not equitable. That's a coin flip. One gets it, one doesn't. There's a decision which is not fair but is equitable. The person who missed breakfast this morning gets it. And then not fair, not equitable is just some other thing occurs. Okay, so that was a thought experiment, but I like that thought experiment. I think it's a good way to force your mind to make sense of this question about fairness and equity. And then what I'll ask you to do now is just take 5 minutes to create your own version of the experiment. And then we will go on now. The last section, the last thing we will talk about, are just some topics in equity, by which I mean some areas of information technology and artificial intelligence that currently have debates ongoing in the academic literature, which tend to involve equity in one way or another. And one of the important debates is this debate about de-skilling. It seems increasingly clear that artificial intelligence is going to take people's jobs away. De-skilling means it takes the human skill and does it better than the human. And so one of those areas is radiology. We've talked about this. This is already happening. We've talked about this for the COVID case, the examinations of lungs for lung cancer and x-rays. Similarly, for the detection of skin cancer in images, there are a lot of jobs already, especially in the medical field and others, where AI is performing as well and or better than humans. And the result is that humans will be displaced from these jobs. The jobs will no longer be there for them. And this will cause, if this happens, I think it's quite clear that if this happens too quickly, if many, many jobs are eliminated, of course, just as a quick footnote, of course, it's always true that technology has always eliminated some jobs. We've had that consistently throughout history, right? That's, in a sense, you could almost say that's what history is. History is the story of jobs being eliminated. Things like we used to have people who would make books by copying, just taking a pen and copying from one page to another. Well, an important moment in history came when that job was eliminated by the printing press, right? So you could say, look, the fact that jobs are being eliminated now is nothing special. And that's true. That's correct. The de-skilling, the elimination of jobs by technology, that is the story of human civilization and history, obviously. Absolutely. The question is, in this case, will it come so quickly that it will be overwhelming? Will it, in some sense, ruin inclusiveness in society, right? If we have many different possible jobs in our world, so if some small area of employees suddenly find that their jobs no longer exist, like the people who are copying manuscripts, usually the society can adjust by absorbing those people into other roles which are similar. So, for example, the people who were copying manuscripts could become people who would craft and produce printing presses, and and most of the jobs would convert, and history would go on just fine. The worry surrounding artificial intelligence and information technology is that the transition will not be so smooth, that the elimination of jobs could be so great and so fast that society itself is fundamentally disrupted. So there's this question about de-skilling, and you can make an argument that if it's true, again, we're just speaking hypothetically now, but let's just say that it's true that artificial intelligence advances will suddenly come so fast that huge swaths of society, of professional positions, of employees, of people working their jobs, will be just eliminated, erased, just like that. You can make a solidarity case that we should not allow that technology, because it will leave people behind, right? If the idea is we're inclusive, we try to bring society together instead of tear it apart, then maybe we could accept a society which has a few people losing their jobs, but we can't have a society where over the course of 5 years, half the people suddenly no longer have jobs, right? So we can make a solidarity argument that artificial intelligence should be limited, that the applications should be constrained so that people keep their jobs, even if that means technology is not allowed to advance as fast as it would otherwise. Of course, there are arguments going the other way, too, but that's a solidarity argument. And then there's a curious historical precedent for this, kind of tangential precedent. In Plato's and Socrates' work, Plato tells the story that it's a mythical story. When writing was invented, the inventor came to the inventor was a god, actually, in the story, and the inventor came to the king. So the gods were below the kings in this story, right? The gods were less than humans. You love the Greeks. So the god came to the king and said, "Look, king, I've invented this new thing called writing, and it's great because it's going to help our memory. Right? Instead of having to remember what we get at the supermarket, now we can write down potatoes, pears, peaches, whatever we're going to get." And the king said, thought about it for a while and said, "You know what? I am going to prohibit this invention." Why? Because you say that it helps memory, but actually it doesn't. It destroys memory. If now we can just write down what we need at the grocery market, we have no reason to train our minds to remember. So what's going to happen is this skill will atrophy. We will, instead of having our memory helped and improved, we will end up losing it altogether, and we will end up not being able to remember anything. So this writing, which presumably would help our memory, becomes a crutch and finally destroys memory altogether, right? Because it does the work for us. So you can make an argument here. This is connected with the de-skilling and employment argument. You can make the argument here that the de-skilling of the computer science, the computer science advances, it's not just that they're going to cause social problems because they take away too many jobs. There's also some more ephemeral human or almost a dignity problem that's going to occur because people will lose the skill. If machines become better at doing radiology of diagnosing lung cancer than human beings, then pretty soon human beings will forget how to do it. And we'll just have the machines doing this and maybe doing everything. And what happens at the end? At the end, human beings become helpless and hopeless. We can't do everything. Maybe our machines, we will have trained our machines to do everything, but we ourselves will be left unable to do anything. Now, of course, that's hypothetical. And most people would say, look, to the degree to which we are freed from some tasks, we are able to advance and think about even more abstract and intellectually demanding tasks. And that might be true. But in any case, the point I'm trying to make is there are a couple different ways that the idea of solidarity can intersect with this question of de-skilling, this question of artificial intelligence doing human jobs better than humans. One is it threatens to tear society apart if it comes too fast and we end up with half the people unemployed within a five-year period. And the other is a kind of solidarity or dignity argument, which is it leaves people empty of skills. I mean, at least some people. It leaves those who have been displaced empty of skills. And maybe there's just a few people left who actually have to think about things. These are like the super artificial intelligence experts. They're the only ones left who actually have to think. Everyone else is kind of like a little sheep following along behind. Again, this too would be not inclusive, not a society together, but a society torn apart. So that's two issues in the area of de-skilling and solidarity, both against the backdrop of the historical reality that technology, of course, we don't want to just be Luddites here, right? We recognize that technology will always display, people will always be unemployed because of technology. It's always going to happen. Okay, here's another example of how solidarity intersects with some current social realities, and this is the idea of the filter bubble. You might know that a filter bubble is the idea that our, especially our social media, but not only that, because it filters out what kinds of things you are offered, the kinds of accounts that you see and the kinds of movies that I recommended to you and the kinds of political positions that I recommended to you in election season and so on. What our social media and our Netflix and our Spotify's and all that does fairly well is it drives cultural polarization, whether it's political or in terms of entertainment or music or what have you. It drives polarization because it filters out and gives you only things that reinforce your particular and personal interests. That's the idea of the filter bubble. So let's just say that I like 1970s heavy metal music. So I start out by selecting on my Spotify, selecting a few songs by some of those groups. Spotify starts to pick up on that. And then every time I listen to music from now on, I only listen to 1970s heavy metal groups. Before long, I forget that even other kinds of music exists. I don't even know what the word jazz means or what classical means. I just know that music means, you know, heavy guitar and acid rock. So that's what the filter bubble. That's the idea of the filter bubble. The idea that increasingly individuals, you and I, are just pushed into tight, smaller and smaller communities of narrower and narrower interests. And again, it doesn't matter whether it's music or movies or politics or dating or what or food or what have you. Just that we're getting narrower and narrower groups, which obviously stands against the idea of solidarity or inclusiveness, because those two, part of the goal of those two ways of looking at the world is to again, bring society together, unify society, not splinter it apart. And here's an example, kind of a specific example of how this can work within an ethical context. Someone could say, look, user-friendly design and public-friendly, by which they mean, in essence, what's going on here is autonomy is being contrasted against equity. So autonomy design and equity design are sometimes in tension. So you say, let's optimize for individual well-being. In other words, I like 70s rock, so let's give him more 70s rock. What behaviors measurably increase well-being? Having digital conversations with people you know well. Let's say in this case, in my example, it's having digital conversations with people who also like 1970s rock and recommend other 1970s groups that I did not know of. What do some people talk about with friends and family? I'm not sure what they mean by that. Personalized charge content, more tribalism and polarization. Okay, so I just took this from a publication. It's sort of imperfect. I'm not sure how it makes. Digital content, you know, well, I guess it kind of makes sense. But you understand the general idea, right? I mean, of course, if what I like is 1970s rock, and then I go on my social media and I meet other people who are also liking that, and I end up just listening to that more and more, and there's nothing else, then we end up in a world of tribalism and polarization, where we have all these little groups all listening to their own music and no one listening to anyone else's music. So we have the people who are listening to 70s acid rock here, and the people listening to jazz there, and the people listening to blues here, and the people listening to classical over there, and everyone is in their own space, and maybe they start to hate each other, because look, I'm trying to listen to jazz in my apartment, but the guy upstairs keeps playing 1970s heavy metal rock, and it's driving me crazy, and that kind of thing. So you end up in a situation where you have these separated groups, and they hate to drive each other crazy, and polarization and tribalism and all those things. And all of that, right, you could say in terms of music or food or politics or culture or anything else, all of that runs clearly against the idea of equity and solidarity. Now, it runs in favor of autonomy, right? And we're helping people find the music they like and live the way they want to live. So that's ethically good. So it's not the case that there's, as in every situation that we talk about, or almost everyone, it's not the case that there's no right or wrong here. But there is a tension between these values. If you want to go for autonomy, if you say, look, that's what matters, that's where I want to focus my ethical privileging and the way I live, then filter bubbles and tribalism and polarization, that's okay. I mean, that's what happens when you have this kind of autonomy. It's even good. That's what you want. You want kind of balkanization. You want people broken up so they can live the way they want to live better without having to worry about everybody else. Makes a lot of sense. And there's a strong case to be made for that. We've already made it at the start. The case we're making here is the different case. It's the equity case. It's the case that says, look, the problem with doing that is that we end up with a society which is not inclusive, or which is not equitable, or which does not express solidarity. So you have to make your decision, right? We want to have this high autonomy, high polarization world, or this more inclusive, but yes, less autonomy world, because just like we saw with the Will Chamberlain experiment, in one way or another, inclusiveness means taking away personal freedom. It says, look, you who have earned more money, guess what? We're going to take some of it away. You don't get to keep all your money. You who are listening to 70s rock music, guess what? You can't listen only to that. You must listen to some jazz or that kind of thing. So there is, it's true that there's no right or wrong answer to this, but that doesn't mean the question is not charged. The question is very charged. If you want solidarity, you want equity, you're probably going to have to take away people's autonomy. You're probably going to have to force them to do things. That's just true. So you make your choice. Do you want to have autonomy with tribalism, or do you want to have less tribalism but less freedom? Okay, and then last point, there's the hyper-equity, the uniformity social, that kind of leading up, what I was just saying leads up to that. I mean, if we're going to have a hyper-equitable society, if we're always going to give, no matter what, the greatest advantage to the least advantage in everything, in terms of money, in terms of diet, in terms of music, in terms of everything you can think of, then there's a few things we need to do. First, we need to be willing to take away people's freedom. Like, you've acquired money, but we're going to tax you, and we're going to take it away from you. But we also have to be willing to take away people's privacy. Because if we want to say that everyone who is least advantaged is going to be advantaged, then we have to know all of your disadvantages. So, for example, if I'm in charge of this, let's say, I have to know your full medical history. Because remember, I want to help you. If you are blind, I want to make sure that you get the software which helps you see. If you have a certain kind of cancer, I want to make sure that the treatment is sent out to you. So if you are going to always give the greatest advantage to the least advantaged, then you have to know about everybody's personal advantages and disadvantages. You've got to know everything about their life. So in that hyper equity society, you, in order to enforce that society, you not only have to restrict autonomy, you also have to severely restrict privacy. It just will not work otherwise. If you don't know who's disadvantaged, you cannot give them the maximum benefit. And the only way to know who's disadvantaged is to know everything about their life. Tell me about your health. Tell me about your financial situation. Tell me about how your family is doing. Tell me about, so on. Again, here, it's not that there's one or the other, right or wrong. But in ethics, there's no free ride, right? It's never the case that you're just going to say, oh, I want this and it's great. It's never like that, right? You may like the idea of inclusiveness. You may like the idea of no one left behind. I mean, everyone does like those. Everyone likes those ideas. But the question is not whether or not you like them. Everyone likes them. The question is how much you will give up for them. What will you give up for that goal of an equitable society? How much autonomy will you give up? How much privacy will you give up? Okay, so you can take 5 minutes to think about that for yourself. And that concludes this session. What we have done is first we have looked at a real-world example of equity and the administrative decision about how college's incoming class should be formed. Then we looked at the definition of equity, and we said it was formed from two parts, the maximum advantage to the least advantage, and the idea of inclusiveness, no one left behind. Then we went on and we did some comparisons between equity, solidarity on one side and fairness on the other, and showed how they were some ways overlapping, but in some ways different. And then in this last part, we've looked at some of the real world situations in which the ethics of equity is today being mustered in the kinds of discussions that one finds in the world of artificial intelligence and information technology. So I think that's enough for this session.